Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, Atlas isn't shrugging, he's selling. We'll be reminded why Ayn Rand's books are so popular and vilified. But first, something she would object to, potential government regulation. An advisory panel for the Food and Drug Administration is recommending that the FDA ban prescription drugs like Vicodin and Percocet because they contain acetaminophen. The ingredient also found in Tylenol, and an ingredient which the FDA says is the leading cause of liver failure in the U.S. So we start today with Dr. Timothy Johnson, Here and Now contributor and medical editor for ABC News. Dr. Tim, we understand there are 28 billion doses of acetaminophen every year. It's the most popular drug in the U.S. What's the problem with it being in prescription drugs?
The problem is that many people don't even know it's in them, and they will start taking increasing doses of these painkillers for various reasons, sometimes legitimately for pain, sometimes because they start developing a resistance to the drugs and they need more of them. But for one reason or another, they will start taking more of them, not realizing that they are also therefore getting increasing doses of acetaminophen, which can, as you've said, cause problems for their liver.
We also understand that they might maybe pop a Tylenol while taking prescription drugs as well, and then they've also increased the dosage.
That seems to be the big problem, people not realizing the total amount of acetaminophen they're getting from various sources. They might take an over-the-counter Tylenol pill. They might take a cough medicine that has some Tylenol in it. So it adds up, and they don't even realize it.
Well, we're reading a range of numbers, anywhere from 100 to 400 people dying a year from overdoses of acetaminophen, but 56,000 going to the emergency room every year with an acetaminophen overdose. First of all, how would you know? What are the symptoms?
Well, the symptoms are not very clear, other than people get very sick to their stomach sometimes. The problem, the liver failure, is usually fairly slow to develop, and of course it's much more likely to develop in people who have existing liver problems and in people who drink regularly, two or more drinks a day, which will damage the liver. So mostly people just feel sick to their stomach and maybe have realized they've taken too many pills.
And we understand that even recommended doses can cause liver damage?
Well, the current recommended doses are 325 milligrams a pill, but most people take the extra strength, which is 500 milligrams a pill, and they're told to take two of those every 4 hours. So if you do the numbers at 500, that adds up to 4,000 milligrams a day. That's now considered to be the current upper limit of normal. The new recommendations are to keep the two pills to 650 milligrams, that's two 325-milligram pills, and so four times a day, that would add up to 2,600 milligrams. They didn't say that officially, but clearly they're leaning in that direction.
Now, that's the over-the-counter drugs.
That's the over-the-counter drugs.
Well, so what might happen then with the prescription drugs? Would the FDA actually ban them?
That's going to be very interesting to watch. The big ones, Percocet and Vicodin. Vicodin's the number one selling pain medicine in this country. They both have acetaminophen, and the vote to remove them from the market was very close, 20 to 17, very vigorous debate. So I'm guessing that the FDA is maybe not going to follow this recommendation. What they might do instead is come out with extra black box warnings and a lot of more regulation to warn the public, an education campaign, because they are so widely used. And if it's taken in the recommended dose for a limited period of time, no problem. It's not going to cause liver failure.
And in any case, don't take a Tylenol as well.
And don't add on other sources. That's right. I mean, we really have to count on the consumer, meaning all of us, when we take this stuff, to keep track of what we're taking. And I'll make one more point. When you look for acetaminophen on the labels in many of the generic products, sometimes you'll see the word acetaminophen, but many times you're going to see four capital letters, APAP, which is the code for acetaminophen.
So know that that's what you're taking.
Yep.
Well, and there are others, NyQuil, Theraflu, don't require a prescription, but do contain acetaminophen.
Yes.
And then there's children's drugs, like liquid Tylenol. What changes might we see there?
Well, they're going to recommend just one dose for the liquid forms. There are now two doses available. They find that that's confusing to parents, so they're recommending a single dose. The over-the-counter ones were not recommended for removal because experience suggests they don't cause as many problems as do the prescription drugs.
Right. Dr. Timothy Johnson, Here and Now contributor and medical editor for ABC News. Thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Sales of Ayn Rand's book, Atlas Shrugged, with its theme of unfettered and unregulated markets, tripled this year, for a time outselling Barack Obama, who, of course, has continued the Bush administration closing days policy of intervening to rescue markets. Why are Rand's books so popular? Former Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan, a longtime follower and friend of Ayn Rand's, admitted in congressional testimony last fall that he found a flaw in her theory that self-interest is better than regulation, a flaw that shocked him. And Bernie Madoff, whose only guide seemed to be his own self-interest, is in jail. Rand was vilified by conservatives in the 50s and now seems proven wrong. So again, why are people buying her books? Jennifer Burns is professor of history at University of Virginia and author of the upcoming Goddess of the Market, Ayn Rand and the American Right. She joins us now. Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I mentioned Bernard Madoff. Ayn Rand would say what?
Ayn Rand would say that he tried to fake reality and he got what was coming to him.
Because her characters, they might have been called selfish, which he didn't find a pejorative, but they were honest.
And above all, they were creators. They created something of value, whether it was a new metal alloy, a beautiful symphony. And so there's no room in her fiction or in her moral code for someone like Madoff, who is an old-fashioned crook. One of the ideas that Greenspan took from Rand was that people want to be rational in the sense that markets are self-correcting, so reality will out and people will be punished for their misdeeds. Now, we're finding that, yes, people are being punished for their misdeeds, but a lot of other people are getting caught up in the process, and also that you can have someone like Madoff running a con scheme that goes on for years before it's uncovered and can do tremendous damage in the period from when it starts to when the fraud is uncovered. So I think that's something that was not integrated into her theories or her books.
Let's let Ayn Rand describe her own philosophy rather than us paraphrasing it. Here she is speaking with Mike Wallace in 1959. We're going to listen to a good chunk of this. Here she defines her philosophy, which she has named objectivism.
First, my philosophy is based on the concept that reality exists as an objective absolute, that man's mind, reason, is his means of perceiving it, and that man needs a rational morality. I am primarily the creator of a new code of morality, which has so far been believed impossible, namely, a morality not based on faith. Not on faith. Not an arbitrary whim, not an emotion, not an arbitrary edict, mystical or social, but on reason, a morality which can be proved by means of logic, which can be demonstrated to be true and necessary.
All right.
Ayn Rand speaking to Mike Wallace in 1959. She goes on to say, man's only moral goal is his own happiness. She accepts the charges against her, that she's out to destroy almost every edifice in the contemporary American way of life, the Judeo-Christian religion, churches, and a belief in God, because they're based on altruism. And Mike Wallace asks her why she doesn't like altruism.
I would say that I don't like is too weak a word. I consider it evil. And self-sacrifice is the precept that man needs to serve others in order to justify his existence, that his moral duty is to serve others. That is what most people believe today.
Well, yes, we're taught to feel concerned for our fellow man, to feel responsible for his welfare, to feel that we are, as religious people might put it, children under God and responsible one for the other. Now, why do you rebel? What's wrong with this philosophy?
But that is what, in fact, makes man a sacrificial animal, that man must work for others, concern himself with others, or be responsible for them. That is the role of a sacrificial object. I say that man is entitled to his own happiness and that he must achieve it himself, but that he cannot demand that others give up their lives to make him happy, nor should he wish to sacrifice himself for the happiness of others.
Jennifer Burns, what was the reaction to this? Whitaker Chambers, the former communist spy turned conservative hero, wrote in the National Review, how can anyone take Atlas Shrugged seriously? He called it arrogant, dogmatic, verging on totalitarian.
Well, people on the left and the right were pretty much horrified. You mentioned the National Review article. She was also attacked in such mainstream magazines as Time, Newsweek, by the religious press. Catholic World attacked her. She was made fun of in The New Republic, in The Nation. Across the spectrum, commentators, fellow intellectuals, thinkers united in saying everything she has to say is garbage. What's really interesting is at the same time, the book was tremendously popular.
Right. And we want to talk about that, why that was, that she sold over 20 million books worldwide to date. But first, where did this thinking come from? Give us a little bit of biography of her background. We know she came from communist Russia. How did that shape her thinking?
Well, it had a profound effect upon her thinking. Rand was born in 1905 in Russia. She lived through the Russian Revolution, and a few months into the revolution, her father's chemistry shop was nationalized. And for Rand, that became emblematic of altruism. Her father's business was seized for an altruistic purpose to benefit the greater good of the Russian people, and it didn't matter that his livelihood was taken away from him, everything he had achieved was taken away from him, and her family was plunged into poverty from that point on. So when she heard people talking about altruism and caring for others, she thought, what this really means, it means the Red Guard seizing my father's business. Right. It means state power and coercion.
Well, I've got my Atlas Shrugged here, almost 1,300 pages of it.
Uh-huh.
The way the books are written is part of the Ayn Rand story. They can be thrilling and very sensual. I'm just opening arbitrarily. Here's page 768, scene with John Galt and Dagny. And he's speaking to her and saying, do you see how much I am free to do, to experience, to achieve? Do you see that all of it is part of what you are to me, as I am part of it for you? And if I'll see you smile with admiration at a new copper smelter that I built, it will be another form of what I felt when I lay in bed beside you. Lacing, you know, sex through discussion of a copper smelter. How much is that a part of the response to the books?
It's definitely part of it. Actually, one of a very prominent conservative, Russell Kirk, used to say people read her for the, quote, fornicating bits. The fact that she can, as you say, go from a copper smelter to a romantic moment in the bedroom, to Rand, this is all part of the same reality. So the same passions and the same individualism that drive your career should also be part of your most intimate relationships. And so for many of her readers, seeing all pieces of life drawn together and explained and linked up, that's very powerful. And it's very much a part of her appeal. And it's also important to remember that when Rand published these books, it was very unusual to have an independent, career-minded, successful female protagonist. And for some female readers, this was very inspiring.
Well, of course, Ayn Rand also told McCall's magazine that she didn't think a woman should want to be president because it would be unfeminine. And she had longtime affairs. Some conservatives couldn't stomach her morals. We're going to have more on that after a break with Jennifer Burns, author of the upcoming book, Goddess of the Market, Ayn Rand and the American Right. And yes, I'm saying Ayn, it is spelled A-Y-N. We'll have more on that. And later today, grilling tips from around the world. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about the late free market champion Ayn Rand, whose books are now selling like crazy. We're speaking with historian Jennifer Burns. And Jennifer, you say that, like her or not, Rand needs to be recognized for her influence on people. Now, we have a colleague who thought it was important to say that Rand's philosophy is best applied as a personal philosophy, not a socioeconomic system. He says it's true, as she says, that people are driven by their own needs and desires, that there's a tendency to pretend this isn't the case and view her as nutty. But even people who are considered the most altruistic are motivated by what they want, that even do-gooders are essentially selfish.
Yeah, the argument that everybody is selfish no matter what. Mm. Well, one thing that Rand's novels do particularly well, particularly The Fountainhead, is liberate people from a sense of guilt or anxiety about what they've accomplished in their life. And that was her main complaint with altruism. There's really two objections she has to altruism. On the individual level, it makes them feel guilty or ashamed of their success, their accomplishments, the things that they've achieved for themselves. And on a social level, it leads to collectivism, which would go back to something like the seizure of her father's chemistry shop, the idea that those who are accomplished and successful, some of their accomplishments or wealth should be taken from them and given to others. So on the personal level, her books are incredibly powerful because they teach to thine own self be true, follow your heart, follow your dreams, follow your passion, all these very important, very powerful messages. And then she ties them to this whole political and economic system.
Well, and it would seem obvious, and we've touched on it, but why is she criticized?
You know, I think that Ayn Rand is criticized as much for what she leaves out as what she puts in. When you come to understand the subtleties of her thought, many people do agree, yes, it's important to be true to yourself. The capitalist economy does run on self-interest. What's missing in Rand is any type of balancing emphasis on other virtues. For instance, she'll talk about the trader principle. We should interact with other people as traders. We offer them value, they offer us value. It's an equal transaction, and that's the end of it. And it's hard for a lot of people who think, well, there's a lot left out here. What about family? What about children? What about people who are sick or with disabilities?
Yeah. What about giving something to someone without expecting anything in return?
Now, Rand would say you can do that. If it's valuable to you to give something to somebody else, that is a selfish purpose. It's fine. Nobody should come and tell you and lecture to you and hector to you that you should be giving things away. That's what really bothers her. But plenty of other thinkers, conservatives like William F. Buckley, would say, yes, people need to be lectured. They need to be told what's good for other people. The last thing they need to be told is to be selfish, because we're going to be selfish anyhow. What moralists and what morality should do is provide a balance to those natural human tendencies. Rand sees that as a contradiction, and she thinks that's very damaging to people when their natural selfish instincts are taught to be wrong and evil, as she says, altruism teaches.
It reminds me, Jennifer, of the old saying attributed to either Disraeli or Churchill, that if you're young and not liberal, then you have no heart. But if you're old and not conservative, you have no brain. There seems to be an Ayn Rand equivalent, perhaps, that if you're young and you enjoy Ayn Rand, that's okay. But as you get older, if you still do, you have no heart.
I think that that's definitely a cliche and a perception about Rand. And I've talked to just hundreds of people who say, oh, I used to love Ayn Rand, then I moved on.
What do they mean by that?
Well, they talk about the Ayn Rand phase. So I went crazy about Ayn Rand. I read all her books. And then after a while, I decided there were some things missing. A lot of people don't buy her ideas about sexuality. That's probably the one that strikes most people, as she didn't really know what she was talking about there.
Well, we should point out that she had a torrid, long affair with a student who was married to her business partner, in effect, you know, seeming
student
not to
was her business partner.
Yeah. And then had a wife who was also a business partner. And she didn't seem to care at all about trampling on their lives.
Well, she secured their rational consent before she started this affair. Where it got tricky was when the affair ran out of steam, Rand had trouble understanding that. Her emphasis on rationality led her to really denigrate emotional knowledge. If it wasn't empirical data, it didn't fit into her system. And so I think that cut her off and her lover off from an enormous amount of emotional intuition and wisdom that might otherwise have helped them avoid the situation they got into.
I want to get you back to what people say about when they change their mind. This seems to me to be the meat of it, Jennifer. Some people stay with Ayn Rand and then some leave her.
Let me say, first of all, I think the fact that people start with Ayn Rand and that they go on to other thinkers or other ideas, that doesn't make her any less important. It actually signifies she's, for many people, the starting point of an exploration of ideas about themselves, morality, markets. She is one way I like to talk about her is a gateway drug to life on the right, because she often starts people with this very pure sense of markets, capitalism, free market ideology. Now, what might happen is a lot of times religion becomes important to people, and they have trouble squaring Rand's atheism with their own religious commitments or their own family religious history. Part of it is that they start reading other people. In many cases, it's learning more about Rand's life herself. and the sort of unhealthy psychological hold she had on some of her followers that makes people think maybe this isn't the philosophy for life that I'm looking for, because it didn't seem to work out so well for her own life. And for many people, they do characterize it as, oh, well, I grew out of her. The other thing I didn't touch on before, one reason Rand is so compelling is, agree with her or disagree with her, you've got to think through a lot of your basic premises about life and about reality in order to understand what she's saying and in order to make up your mind about it. So even in the process of rejecting her ideas, people can find that a very sort of thrilling and opening experience to clarify, what do I really think? I don't like this novel that much. Why? And Rand sort of pushes you to think very clearly, what are my morals? What are my values? What are my beliefs? And whether you come out agreeing with her or not, that's a very valuable process for many people.
Jennifer Burns is professor of history at the University of Virginia and author of the upcoming Goddess of the Market, Ayn Rand and the American Right. Jennifer, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, still ahead today. Watch out, there's a poisonous snake near your northwest foot. That's how they'd say it in a community in Australia. We'll learn how language we use shapes the way we view the world. That's still to come today, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. What's it like the day after in Iraq? Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shiite cleric whose followers were blamed in the past for some of the country's worst violence, surfaced today with a cautious welcome to the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq's cities. But he says the fact that some Americans are staying on as trainers or advisors shows Iraq and U.S. officials aren't really serious about the timeline for full withdrawal, which is the end of 2011. The BBC's Jim Muir is in Baghdad. Jim, we know that this pullout from the cities has been going on for a while, but yesterday we saw images of people celebrating, and we heard stories about Iraqis worried that Iraqi forces aren't ready to take over. So do you notice anything different today?
One thing I have kind of noticed, and that is that there's far fewer helicopters riding around in the sky. We used to get them buzzing low over our roof. We're on one of the regular routes across to the green zone. And when things were at their height here, we had them going over every few minutes, and it was really quite annoying because they're very loud. But that is one kind of audible, if you like, and slightly visual sign that things have changed. Yeah. But otherwise, for a lot of Iraqis, it hasn't made a huge amount of difference.
Well, what about up north? There was a car bombing in Kirkuk yesterday that killed more than 30 people. This was in the Kurdish section of that city. What do you read into that attack? Because we had seen huge attacks in the run-up to the withdrawal date, and it was assigned by many to sort of the last gasps of insurgency, al-Qaeda, in Iraq. What do you make of the Kirkuk bombing?
I think it falls into that pattern, but also, as you suggested, there are special considerations up in Kirkuk. There's a kind of ethnic fault line that runs through that region between Kurds and Arabs. Kirkuk is a disputed city, a disputed province, and an oil-rich province at that, so it's quite a prize.
Well, you mentioned the lucrative oil reserves up there in the northern city of Kirkuk, and that brings us to yesterday's oil auction in Baghdad. It was supposed to be another sign of progress. It was televised nationally, the government selling licenses to companies to operate in Iraq's oil fields. These were the oil fields that were nationalized by Saddam Hussein in the 70s, now up for sale. What happened?
It went wrong. Basically, the critics of Mr. Shahristani, the oil minister, appeared to be correct. Now, he had hopes of that there would be a kind of literally an auction, that people would be queuing up, the majors, the oil majors, including Exxon and various other world majors, queuing up to come in here, even on not that exciting contracts, but with the idea of getting in on the ground floor, as it were, because everybody knows Iraq is sitting on the world's third biggest oil reserves. These contracts were for existing fields, and they were service contracts whereby these companies would take on the task of increasing production at these fields. They would put the money into it, and they would then get their payback from the extra oil that they would be responsible for bringing out. Now, the price that they were being offered by the government was $2 per barrel for that extra oil. They wanted at least $4 per barrel to make it worth their while. Only one of these bidders, a consortium led by British Petroleum, actually stuck in there and did take this not very exciting offer from the Iraqi government. All the others have basically flunked out.
And you said that this idea did have its critics. Why wouldn't people want to get in on the ground floor of Iraq's oil industry?
There were several things. One is that there is no oil and gas law, no new oil and gas law. It's been consistently held up in Parliament. Politically, it ran into problems, and not least because many of the oil executives here, the people in the state oil companies, the engineers and so on, were dead against these contracts too, because at these existing fields, Iraq itself has already made substantial investments of its really diminishing cash into those fields. And if the fear was that that cash would be wasted if the majors came wading in after them. So that is one reason why there was very strong domestic opposition to it. It's not nationalistic. It was purely for business reasons. And another reason why I think quite a lot of people here would be kind of, I think, schadenfreude is the right word. They'd be quite pleased to see Mr. Shahristani fail at this.
Well, is there also another side effect of this? Those Iraqis who thought that the entire conflict, the whole war in Iraq, was about the U.S. in particular wanting Iraqi oil, they certainly saw yesterday that nobody was jumping at Iraqi oil.
There was this kind of knee-jerk nationalistic reaction at one stage, but there is a recognition across the board, pretty much, that the oil majors do have to come in here because Iraq can't do it itself.
That's the BBC's Jim Muir speaking to us from Baghdad. Jim, thanks as always.
Most welcome, Robin.
Okay, we'll take a break. And then how the language you speak can shape the way you view the world. Back in 30 seconds, here and now. There are an estimated 7,000 languages in the world. Each is different. Does it follow that people who speak different languages maybe think differently? Well, Dr. Lara Boroditsky says yes. She's an assistant professor of psychology and neuroscience at Stanford University and has written an essay on all this for the new book, What's Next? Dispatches on the Future of Science. And Professor Boroditsky joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Professor, your research takes us to the far corners of the earth. I want to start, though, with a small Aboriginal community in northern Australia that you studied, because of the way they speak about space. Instead of using words like right, left, forward, back, how do they speak?
The languages here, this is Pormpuraaw in Australia, rely on words like north, south, east, and west. These are required for any kind of spatial reference. So you have to say things like, there's an ant on your southwest leg, or the boy standing to the north-northwest of Mary is my brother. In order to say anything spatial, you have to know exactly which way you're facing all of the time. In fact, even to say hello, the way we say hello in English, you say, oh, how are you? Fine. In Pormpuraaw, you say, where are you going? And the answer has to be something like, north-northeast in the far distance. How about you? So if you don't know which way you're heading, you can't get past hello there.
This is amazing. One that I'm looking at, I love. Move the cup to the north-northwest a little bit. So obviously they're speaking differently, but you set out to test if they were thinking differently. You gave them different pictures, and they did what with them?
Well, what we wondered was how people who think about space in this way think about other things that we in our culture tend to spatialize. So in English, we often talk about time, abstract things, as if they were space. So we say, let's move a meeting forward or push the deadline back. And we thought, well, these folks talk about north, south, east, and west. Would they also think about time in terms of north, south, east, and west? So we gave them sets of pictures. For example, one set was a set of pictures of my grandfather at different ages, from when he was a young boy to an older man. And I would give them to a person and just ask them to lay them out on the ground in the right order. If you ask an English speaker to do this, then what they do is lay these cards out from left to right. When we asked the folks in Pormpuraaw to do this, they did something quite different. And at first, it looked like there's no pattern. So if they were seated facing south, they would lay the cards out from left to right. If they're seated facing east, they lay the cards out as coming towards them. It turns out all of those are going from east to west. So in these communities, everything relates to the landscape. The landscape holds all of the history and the cultural meaning, and time is also laid out in the landscape. Huh. So unlike us taking time with us always, whichever way we're facing, it's always going with respect to our bodies. For them, time is laid out directly in the landscape in absolute cardinal directions.
You also looked at how grammar can change the way we view the world. You give the example of gender. Some languages assign gender to nouns. German and Spanish do. And you wanted to see if Germans and Spanish viewed the different words in a more feminine or masculine light because of gender assignment. What did you do and what did you find?
We just gave a list of words to Spanish and German speakers, and these words had opposite grammatical gender in the two languages. And for each word, we just said, give us three adjectives that describe this object in the world. And what we saw were really strikingly different adjectives that people came up with. So to give you an example, the word bridge is feminine in German, and it's masculine in Spanish. And German speakers said things like beautiful, extended, elegant.
So these were words the Germans used to describe bridges, which, again, the word bridge is feminine in German, so elegant and beautiful. How did the Spanish describe a bridge?
The Spanish speakers said things like strong, long, thrilling, towering, a very different set of descriptions.
But why is it important that that gets so highlighted?
If you can show that, for example, grammatical gender can shape the way you think about an object, that means that the very mechanics of language, not what you say, but how you have to say it just in order to be able to speak grammatically, can shape how you think about anything that can be named by a noun. There's a lot of stuff that can be named by a noun. And there are lots of other grammatical differences that have much more immediate relevance.
Well, give us one.
One example I really like has to do with how we talk about causal events and especially accidents. So suppose there is a cup on a table and I grabbed it in anger and smashed it on the ground. You might say Lara broke the glass. If I just accidentally brushed up against it and it again fell to the ground, it would still be okay in English to say Lara broke the cup. Now, in lots of languages, you would not use the same description for an accident as you would for an intentional action. So in Spanish, for example, if it was an accident, you would be much more likely to say something like the cup broke itself. And so what we wondered is, does it mean that if you're not mentioning the agent in an accidental situation, does that mean you don't care as much who did it? Maybe you won't assign as much blame to the person. And so we showed a bunch of videos of intentional and accidental actions to Spanish speakers and English speakers. And we found when actions are intentional, everyone remembers really well who did it. But when actions are accidental, English speakers, they remember who did it. Mm. Whereas Spanish speakers no longer care.
Well, where do you take this? Where does this lead you?
Well, there are obvious implications for eyewitness memory. You can ask even questions about what we value in a culture. Why is it that in our culture it's really important to assign blame for every event outcome?
So are you saying Americans might be more litigious because of their language?
It's certainly a possibility that's been suggested in the literature. People who have analyzed legal systems around the world have noticed that there are very different ideas of responsibility. One root of that could be the way we describe causal events.
That's Dr. Lara Boroditsky, Assistant Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at Stanford. Dr. Boroditsky, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And we have time for this quick news note from Utah, where the largest pub crawl in state history is planned for today in celebration of what some are calling Private Club Independence Day, because starting today in Utah, bars will no longer be treated like private clubs. 40 years ago, state liquor laws were passed largely to prevent the state's large teetotaling Mormon population from being exposed to alcohol, and the laws required customers to fill out an application and pay a fee before entering a bar, in other words, become a member. It got confusing. Hotel guests were automatically enrolled at hotel bars through their room fees, and no memberships were required in beer-only bars. But starting today, that all goes away in an effort to attract tourists and businesses. Governor John Huntsman, a non-drinking Mormon, told the Associated Press, "We're rolling out the welcome mat to the world." Having spent a lot of time in Utah, it's hard to imagine that Bacchanalia will follow. Well, stay right there. When we come back, grilling here in New England, it includes umbrellas. That's in 1 minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back to Here and Now. And here we are now on the deck of our mothership, WBUR in Boston, overlooking Commonwealth Avenue. Terrific smells in the air. And a grill going. That must mean Here and Now's resident chef, Kathy Guntz, cooking up some special items for us. Kathy, good to see you as always.
Hi, Robin. This is our annual day.
Yes, it
is. This is our It Must Be Summer Day.
And I always wonder what people in surrounding buildings think we're doing out here.
I think they're smelling it, and maybe they're jealous.
Well, July 4th coming up. Everyone thinks of celebrating by the grill. We think of it as an American tradition, but you've told us in the past, grilling is global.
It sure is. I just finished working on a whole book about grilling, and I was introduced to Korean barbecue, incredibly succulent short ribs, glazed in soy and mirin, really, you know, sticky, sweet, delicious, fall-off-the-bone kind of things, Japanese eggplants with ginger and soy. Wherever you travel, anywhere in the world, you will see fire, and you will see people cooking things on that fire, because it really is the most primitive, elemental way. It's where we started.
Well, what have you got on the grill here? Something just popped.
Yeah, it did. Well, first of all, the reason you heard a pop is that I'm using real charcoal. This is hardwood charcoal. It's not a processed product. It's not coated with chemicals. It's an all-natural product. It's right over here.
Okay. Got it right here. Hardwood lump charcoal.
Exactly. And what you're hearing pop is because it's not a solid. It's a piece of lump charcoal, but it's got air moving through it. So it burns really evenly and smoothly. And I want to avoid chemicals in my food, on my food, under my food. So I look for that.
Okay, so what have we got here?
The Vietnamese make what may well be the best sandwich in the entire world. And it's crusty baguette, a French bread, so you have the crunch of the bread. And it's traditionally layered with marinated steak. Today we're doing it with chicken. And I've marinated it overnight with lemongrass, garlic, fish sauce, soy sauce, a little bit of oil. And I threw all the marinade ingredients in a blender, whirl it up, and just throw it on the chicken and walk away. Go to sleep. Wake up the next day. Party time. Make a hot fire. You take it out of the marinade, and you cook this chicken breast for just about 3 or 4 minutes on each side. And as I mentioned, traditionally you would do this with a skirt steak or a very thin steak. And then that's thinly sliced, and it's placed right on the French bread. And I'm just going to flip this over, and then I'm going to show you how I put the sandwich together. So these are the makings of our Vietnamese sandwich. You'll see a lot of colors and textures. I've got the crusty baguette here, which we're just going to pop open, and we're going to throw this on the grill for just a minute, just to get it nice and warm. Then I've made a coleslaw, not your traditional American coleslaw. This uses grated carrots and grated daikon, which is an Asian radish. It's a big white thing, and it's very sweet, and you can actually find it in grocery stores and Asian markets. And all I did was mix it with a little bit of rice wine vinegar and sugar.
Can I taste this?
Please taste that. It's so sweet. A little bit of sour and a little bit of sweet, which are really the elements of the sandwich. And the crunch?
That's lovely.
Incredibly refreshing. We also have fresh mint, which to me is the flavor of summer, and fresh cilantro, coriander. So we open our bread. We've toasted it. We're going to rub one side of it with a mixture here of fish sauce and oil and soy sauce.
By the way, we'll have all these ingredients on our website.
And on the other side, believe it or not, mayonnaise, plain old mayonnaise like everyone knows. We're going to layer a little bit of our daikon and gratish carrot slaw on top.
Oh, you're putting the coleslaw in the sandwich.
Putting the coleslaw on the sandwich. I'm going to put the whole cilantro leaves in the sandwich and whole mint leaves. What's this going to do is bring really bright, fresh, summery Asian flavors in. Then we're going to layer our grilled chicken on top. We're going to close it up, and we're going to eat it. All the elements can be made ahead of time. Really fun for a party. I guarantee you, your neighbors are not serving this.
Well, and I'm thinking, too, because you always try to bring everybody to the grill. You could put tofu in that sandwich.
Absolutely. You could just grill a bunch of onions and vegetables and squash, layer on the daikon and the carrot slaw. But the fresh mint and the cilantro is really going to bring out these traditional Vietnamese flavors. And I have one for you.
Okay.
All ready to go.
It's a very wide sandwich.
It is wide, and you're going to get a good crunch.
It's snappy.
It is. And it's not a hamburger, and it's not a hot dog, and yet it takes no effort at all. Now, the second dish is probably simpler. Let's go back to the grill, and we're going to get some corn on the cob. So corn on the cob is just coming into season now. It's only going to get better as we head into August. And in this case, you strip it down. You pull all the husks and all the silk off. You don't have to soak it. And you put it right on the hot grill.
Well, but I can see that part of our corn on the cob here is getting toasted.
It's getting a little blackened, and that's exactly what we want, because the sweet kernels are going to get tender, and we are then going to coat them in a mayonnaise sour cream mixture and sprinkle a Mexican cojito cheese on or a feta cheese, and then sprinkle it with chili powder. So once again, we're going to have juicy, sweet, spicy, and creamy. So you take the corn, and as you noticed, it is a little bit blackened. You absolutely want that. That's not a problem. And we're going to put it on our plate here. And while it's hot, we're going to spread a mixture, as I said. This is regular old sour cream and mayonnaise with a little bit of salt and pepper.
It's going right on it.
We're
going to
smear it on. And you see this on the streets in Mexico from street vendors. They have little charcoal briquettes. Then I'm going to sprinkle, I'm using a feta, but if you can find a hard, crumbly Mexican cheese. And obviously this corn is very hot, so the cheese is just going to start to melt. And then we're going to take our chili powder, and we're going to sprinkle a little bit on, and we're going to add a lot of color and a little bit of heat.
This is unbelievable. This is, it's corn cob as vehicle.
Yes, okay. That's right.
It's loaded.
It's, there you go. And that's your corn on the cob. And as I said, this is the kind of thing you can buy for a few pesos on the street throughout Mexico. And it's stunning.
I'm going to try this.
Yeah.
It's a mess.
It's a mess, but it's a good mess.
Mm-hmm.
So these are just some of the ideas of ways to use international flavors, breaking out of that standard thing that most Americans do every Saturday night.
Okay, Kathy, we're all listening now. We want our marching orders. Just list of do's and don'ts, equipment that we need, just tick it off for us.
You don't need much. You need a good brush to clean the grill. You want to get your grill super hot. Don't worry about cleaning it first. Maybe you cooked last night, maybe last week. Once the grill is super hot, you take a wire brush and you're going to scrub the grates. That's going to get it clean. You don't need to oil it. That's a real misconception about grilling. What happens when you oil the grates is that you get flames because the oil drips. Number two, a pair of tongs. You don't want to be piercing food with a fork. Tongs are fabulous because you just flip food over and you never have to lose juices, whether it's a steak, chicken, swordfish, corn on the cob, anything.
Longer the better tongs.
Absolutely, because you don't want to burn your finger. You need a grilling platform for little pieces. This just looks like the grill, but it has small perforations on it. And that's for itty-bitty things when you're grilling little shrimp or you're grilling pieces of zucchini or squash so they don't fall through. You know what?
What?
You don't need much else. All that other stuff is icing.
Oh, like bowls of water and...
Okay, you know what you need? You need a $2 plastic plant sprayer that you water your indoor plants with, because when you get a flare-up, if you have any marinade that's still on something you're grilling, it's going to drip and you're going to get a flare of fire. And there you are with your $2 plant sprayer. Squirt, squirt, it's out, no problem.
Kathy Gunst reminding us again on July 4th that American cooking has a lot of traditions in it. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. Enjoy it all and, you know, get outside, do some cooking and experiment.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.